First of all, the timing on this isn't great. It's still very, very close to the tragedy, to the suffering, to the mourning. I just came from Beitar, where we went to several houses, just visiting people and families who had lost no one, just visited people. So I'd really like to give the shiur a little bit, a few more days after, but this is the slot of the chug, and next week is going to be a little difficult. So just keep in mind that we're still trying to process the two. Not overindulge in mourning, but still in the appropriate fashion. It's still the week of Avelis. I'll try to, if I can, merge a little bit of the conversation tonight with some of what we experienced. If any of you want to see a larger attempt to synthesize, the article I wrote this week for the newspapers, which I write every week, I put on a YU Tower. So there's an article, about a 1,500 word article about Yom Yerushalayim in Meron. So you can just pull it down from YU Tower. It's a text. It's actually read something. Okay, so Yom Yerushalayim, 1967, it's not an obvious day. It's a day that isn't celebrated with the same national sweep and the same international sweep as Yom HaTzmaut. Yom HaTzmaut is national, it's international. I think every one of you had some ceremony, some event, some gathering, some party. I don't know how many of you had a real Yom Yerushalayim experience. It's a lot harder. You don't have the country, you don't have the city, you don't have the Kotel, you don't have the props. Somehow the flag is sufficient for Yom HaTzmaut, the country, the state, but the city being absent from Yom Yerushalayim is a little harder. Unfortunately, in the country itself, the Yom Tov, the holiday, has shrunk a little bit. And secular Jews don't really mark it because the Six-Day War has undergone a lot of historical revisionism. It's become politicized, and we'll talk about that. Haredim obviously don't mark the day. Because it's shrunk, professionals don't keep the day either because it's not a national holiday. So it ends up being celebrated by Hesder Yeshivas. It's being celebrated by 5,000 boys and girls who are your age. Obviously, there are some events and people think about it. They say, hello. But my purpose with you is not to try to resuscitate Yom Yerushalayim nationally, but to help you have a sense, why are we celebrating? Why are we taking off time? Why are we going to Yerushalayim? Let's try to divide Yom Yerushalayim into three layers. For the next 15 minutes, I'm not going to say one word. Well, I may say it, but not too often. You know which word I'm not going to say for the next 15 minutes? I'm not going to say the word Yerushalayim. What I am going to discuss is what happened during the Six-Day War. Because even if we never sniffed Yerushalayim, and we never thought we'd sniff Yerushalayim in 1967, the events that unfolded in 1967 were miraculous. In ways that far surpassed the events of 48. And again, because of historical revisionism, the war has been reconfigured, remodeled as a war of aggression and territories and Judea, Samaria, occupation. It was the furthest thing from the truth. So a little bit of history. In 1967, General Nasser of Egypt took command of all the Arab armies. You can wiki this, you can YouTube it. And evicted the UN from the Suez Canal. And he hurled his nefarious threat. Now it's cartoonish, but in those days it resonated with real horror, real shock. This was 19 years after the Holocaust. When we talk about Holocaust survivors, these are elderly people who have long since dealt with the trauma of being interviewed for the Spielberg Project, being taken. These were... You walked out in the street, it was Holocaust. You walked, the grocer was a Holocaust survivor, the bus driver was a Holocaust survivor, you went to the graves of that, you lived Holocaust 19 years afterwards. And he threatened to hurl the Jews into the sea. That's the phraseology the General Nasser used, and you know what? Those days it made a lot of sense. Because the Israeli state was fledgling, because the years between 48 and 67 were not robust years, they're not the state that you recognize, not even the state of Israel that I recognized when I was here. I was in the car today with some boys who asked me, tell us about the state of Israel in the 80s. A lot poorer, closer to the third world, a lot more bad. By the 1950s, it was food rationing. There were wars of attrition. You had to come with food stamps to the store to get your pound of flour, your kilo of flour for the week. And complete diplomatic isolation. This is before America started arming Israel to the teeth. We had no allies. The UN was evicted from the Suez Canal. And you know what they started doing in public parks? Jeremy, please close the door. Public parks, they started to dig 50,000, 60,000, 70,000 graves. Images that were apocalyptic, sadly, I mean, not sadly, gladly they were apocalyptic until recently, where you see pictures of graves being dug in India or in Mexico because the local cemeteries can't handle the volume of corona victims. There were gallows humor being spread around. Last person to leave Ben-Gurion, shut the lights. These are the jokes that, Wheaton jokes, the gallows humor we heard. People were expecting the country, okay, it was a nice attempt, it's a good shot, we tried, we had to stay 19 years, who knows, maybe in 50 years we'll come back, but we have to leave now because Hitler, because Nasser's going to finish Hitler's job. Women and children. My aunt, Alea Shalom, who just passed away about 2 months ago, was one of the women and her children who were sent back from Israel to England, to the United States, to South Africa, to get out of harm's way. Because that's the, I can't use any other word, that's the Holocaust that people fear. Weeks and weeks and weeks, kids would show up in school. No courses, no classes, no papers. They would come to school, open a Tehillim, say a couple hours of Tehillim, go home. The entire country was waiting for the war. And no one's mind, you know, generals, their job is to war plan for any scenario as remote as it could possibly be. Because in the heat of the battle, you don't have the time and equanimity to plan a battle. So you prepare every possible scenario, as crazy and as outlandish as it is. Every potential scenario has already been planned for. Projects, table, in the drawer, you pull it out. It's called Tochnet Megira. You pull it out of the drawer, and you're in plan. It's in the drawer. In people's wildest minds, no one dreamed of going back to Yerushalayim, entering Rekhavara. This was a defensive war. We launched it because we saw the writing on the wall. But the entire stance was we just have to defend ourselves. If we just allow the Egyptians to continue to mass, to continue to mobilize on the Suez Canal, then we'll suffer as we almost suffered in 73 during the Yom Kippur War. And all of a sudden, people went down to their basements the first night of the war. When I say basements, there were no bomb shelters. You went to the basement because in a basement, you stood a 50-50 chance of survival if the building was bombed. If you were on an upper floor and the building's bombed, so then you probably die, either because of a direct hit or because the rubble, shrapnel, collapse, upper floors. If you're in the basement, so essentially, depending on which part of the building it's bombed, you may survive. No bomb shelters. Basements. And people came out of those basements in the morning after the first night, and they heard over the Voice of America that the Egyptian Air Force no longer exists. No longer exists. The Egyptian Air Force had been eliminated in a surprise raid. I mean, wars are fought for hundreds of years. You've heard the phrase 100 years war, 40 years war. And what does it mean for the entire world to change in 6 days? Well, it happened once when Hashem created the world in 6 days. It happened a second time when Hashem created the redeemed world in 6 days. Just try to wrap those ideas around your head, how quickly things happened. The timelines were off. It was hallucinatory. People just didn't know what was happening. It was happening so quickly. For weeks and months, we had begged King Hussein, father of current King Hussein, stay out of the war. This isn't your battle. We have no beef with you. We're fighting the Syrians. We're fighting the Egyptians. This is not your battle. And then, as General Nasser's divisions are being surrounded in the Sinai Desert, General Nasser sends a telegraph. This is all documented. I strongly encourage you, the next couple of days, Wiki or YouTube, just 6 day war. Not Yerushalayim. Just forget the Yerushalayim part. Just what happened. Read the like dreamers. There's a whole litany. There's a whole industry of books that celebrate the events. And also, there's a telegraph sent from General Nasser to King Hussein. Come join us. Egyptian divisions are marching on Ashdod. Egyptian divisions are marching on Ashkelon. They're being surrounded in the Sinai Desert, raising white flags of surrender. Come join us in the battle. And then Hussein's duped. Leaps into the battle. Hashem intervened in the human heart, just like he sometimes does. And just the images, the words themselves, Omdos on the Israeli radio, Omdot Hayu Raglinu Bisharach, they read that parak in Tehillim. Let me take you back 19 years, because you take it for granted. 48 was a lot of euphoria, but there was a lot of pain in 48. And some of the pain, a lot of the pain in 48, if you read the speeches of the time, I've read speeches of Yom Yerushalayim. I was obviously alive, but not old enough to register the events. It was very sad in 48 to be evicted from Yerushalayim. Keep in mind, Jews had been able to visit the Kotel, whatever it was like before 67, but they'd been able to visit the Kotel. They'd been able to daven at Kever Rachel. They'd been able to daven at Maris Machpelah. Now after 48, after the armistice, and after it was clear that there was tension and hostility between Jordanians who control the other part of Israel and Israelis, you couldn't go to the Kotel. You couldn't even look at the Kotel. You'd be sniped at. You couldn't even get near the Old City. You couldn't visit Kever Yosef, Kever Rachel, Maris and Machpelah. These were all now off limits to Jews. And there was a sense of, right after the Holocaust, right after it felt as if Hashem had turned his back on us in Europe. He didn't, but it felt that way. Once again, he turned his back on us in Israel. And now we can't go up. There's a real pain of not being able to get close to the Kotel, not getting close to the Arabai, not getting close to... And now 19 years later, we're invited back. Come back. Come back to the Kotel. One of the aspects of overlap that I spoke about just today when I was at the Beis Avel. So I'm sitting in a house, the name of the house was, I think, Goldberg. There's four Hasidic brothers in full Hasidic garb. And the father, hard to see a father, must have been maybe, let's say, maybe late 60s, maybe early 70s. I don't know the age of the person that was killed, but they thought about it, mid-30s. It's about five brothers, I guess. And the father was saying that the Rav of Beitar had consoled him. It's a very provocative, and I'm sure it makes a lot of us think, but just, and I don't want you to question, I just want you to listen to the wavelengths they operate on and admire and just how you process these experiences. You may disagree with the processing, but don't disagree. The Rav of Beitar, by Weiss, I think is his name, had told the father, and he's retelling to some of the people there, that very few people have the, I think he used the word tzchus, I don't know if he used the word tzchus, but whatever, have the experience where you go to Shemayim when 20,000 people sang Shema Yisrael. Evidently, this tragedy happened. I guess after that said Shema Yisrael, a lot of people talk about Meron, talk about this mass explosion of spiritual energy with masses of people screaming Shema Yisrael and masses of people screaming Ani Mami. Now again, it's a hard comment, obviously, but part of returning to Eretz Yisrael is being with masses of Jews. Your great-great-great-great-grandfather, the largest gathering of Jews he probably ever was with, again, maybe even Israel, before we return to Israel, part of Galus is living in small shtetlach, even if they're big cities, 200,000, 300,000. What does it mean to stand with 500,000 people? We've done that in Israel. What does it mean to say Shema Yisrael with thousands and thousands? We've done that in Israel, but we hadn't in the past. So all of a sudden we're back in Yerushalayim, and all of a sudden Har HaBayis Bi'adeinu, and all of a sudden we're marching back to the Kotel. And the first mass gathering was Shavuos. They worked for a week between Yom Yerushalayim and Shavuos to clear the rubble, to pave the plaza. And the first time Jews were allowed to go back to the Kotel was Shavuos. Around 200,000 people went to the Kotel for Shavuos. It's, again, it was like an event. People, we still talk, remember the event. That's probably the first time in 2,000 years that 200,000 Jews gathered anywhere. When did 200,000 Jews gather since they left Yerushalayim in the days of the Romans? So when you say during Hallel, Zeh Hayom Asa Hashem Megila V'Nisim Chavo, forget Yerushalayim. Forget. Just, we were saved Me'afela Li'ora. Afafuni Chav Le'moves U'mitzari She'ol Mitzuni. Tzara V'yogun Emtza V'Shem Hashem Ekra. Min HaMeitzar Karasika Anani V'Merchavka. We literally thought that hundreds, tens of thousands of people would be killed and the country would be evicted. And Hashem saved us. And when I think about Yom Yerushalayim, I think about the following psukim. The psukim source number one, 15th year of Amatzia rules in the south. Northern kingdom is ruled by Yeravam. Not the Yeravam you know, Yeravam ben Yoash, the iniquitous evildoer. Same, his successor, Yeravam ben, not Yeravam ben Nevat, but Yeravam ben Yoash. So another Yeravam. He's the northern king. But he's just as wicked and just as diabolical as Yeravam. Source number one, part line two, Vayas Harab Bnei Hashem, Lo Sar Mikol Chatos Yeravam Ben Nevat, just like his ancestors, just like his predecessor's namesake. What happens during Yeravam Ben Yoash's reign? This is the big, look at me, tzaddik. Right, my eyes are hurting today, I can't wink. But the big tzaddik, Yeravam Ben Yoash. What happens during his reign? Hu Eishiv Eskevul Yisroel Megevoh Hamas Ad Yam Haravah. He leads to grand territorial expansion to the Mediterranean Sea. Kidvar Hashem Elokei Yisrael, Shediber Bi'aravdo Yonah Ben Amitai, as Hashem had told Yonah Ben Amitai. This is one of the only times that Yonah appears in Tanakh outside of Megillas Yonah. Yonah prophesies. Whale boy. This is the whale of Moby Dick. He prophesies about this great expansion. Why is this Russia leading such a Yeshua? This is not Moshe Rabbeinu. This is not the Chafetz Chaim. This is not Shimshon. This is Yerava ben Yoash. He's a Russia. He's a murderer. Well, read this passage and see if you can conjure 1967. Ki ra Hashem es ani Yisrael morem o. Three lines at the bottom. Hashem saw the plight of the Jewish people was bitter. The Efes Atzur, the Efes Azul, the Ein Ozer li Yisrael. No allies, no help. This is literally, these 1967 is stripped from these words. It's like these are prophecies about 1967. V'lo diber Hashem limchos Hashem yisrael mitachas ha-shamayim. Hashem refused to allow the Jewish people to be eliminated. V'yoshiem b'yad Yerava ben Yoash. So Hashem saved us that day through Yerava ben Yoash. Well, if Hashem can save us through Yerava ben Yoash, He can rescue us through Ariel Sharon and Mata Gur and Moshe Dayan. Those are the heroes of the Six-Day War. If you don't know who they are, you should probably look them up. Those are the three or four most important generals during that period. You've heard of Sharon and Dayan, Mata Gur was. If HaKadosh Baruch Hu can save us through Yerovam ben Yoash, and that's the first layer of Yom Yerushalayim, before we talk about the symbolic meaning of the city, it's just Yeshua. Just had not. I said before, there's some Haredim, many, but some, who even though they don't say Hallel on Yom HaTzmut, there is a Shita out there that people say Hallel on Yom Yerushalayim. Because of this. Because you can debate from here to Wazoo ideology, redemptive messianic thought, is it Yad Hashem? But when people are saved and the dimensions of this Yeshua, you just have to say Hallel. It's not a question of ideology. There is a Shita out there. There are people who say Hallel on Yom Yerushalayim. That's the first layer. Second layer is, of course, now I'll say the word, Yerushalayim. And what does Yerushalayim mean to us? And what does Yerushalayim mean to other people? Well, there's an interesting Gemara in Brachos Memtes, in which the Gemara is considering what ending for the third bracha of Birchas HaMazon. There are four brachos. The third is the final Deraisa bracha. How should it end? Tanur Abar, Malchosin, Bevinyan Yerushalayim. As we say, Boni Barachav of Yerushalayim. Rabbi Yosef Yehuda ben Moshiach Yisrael. Not to be more general about Jewish salvation, Moshiach Yisrael. At which point, someone in the Beis Medrash heard Rabbi Yosef's statement. Got to hold his water down. Banged his fist on the table and said, what? Moshiach Yisrael in Binyan Yerushalayim below? Can you talk about Hashem saving and rescuing the Jewish people without Yerushalayim? It's like, it's ridiculous. What do you mean, Moshiach Yisrael? So he says, whoa, slower. I didn't mean that. I meant, Moshiach Yisrael. Of course you have to mention Yerushalayim. What are you accusing me of? Of course you say Yerushalayim. I just wanted to also say Moshiach Yisrael. So Machlokes never was taught meant Yerushalayim. What a great. Or should you say Bonei Baracham of Yerushalayim? Or should you say, as a Pias, you thought Bonei Baracham of Yerushalayim or Moshiach Yisrael? So we paskin Moshiach Yisrael is implicit. You can't talk about Jewish redemption without a location, without a set of coordinates. Jews live in history. To live in history means there's a starting point and an ending point. And the starting point is the same as the ending point because history is cyclical. And where history began, where human beings were formed from, where Adam Arishon's ashes were Adam Arishon's dust was taken from, where he was created from, that's where history will end. And it's cyclical. And if the Jewish redemption is meant to redeem humanity as well, then it has to end up in Yerushalayim, with the Jews returning to Yerushalayim. There's no redemption. I mean, there could be minor redemptive events, but full-scale historical redemption cannot be severed from Yerushalayim. And all of a sudden, when we return to Yerushalayim, the process began in a way that didn't begin in 1948. 1948 was a very, very different feel redemptively. 1948 was, I mean, we celebrated, but it's a little bit lukewarm. We lost land. We were evicted from our territories. We won Yerushalayim. It was rather easy for the world to accept because it placated their guilty conscience. It solved the refugee problem. You've all seen the faded 8mm reels of Jews on these steamboats being ported from country to country. Now there's a place to send the Jews. For it was not the same redemptive fervor. 67, the world wakes up. When Jews return to Yerushalayim, the world is in a very, very different state of affairs. When Jews return to Yerushalayim, process begins. And you can't be pyro about the process. You're either really excited about the process. Let me ask all the South Africans and Australians in this room to turn to their American counterparts tonight. Just go over to America and say, could you explain this thing I've heard that there are tens of millions of Christian fundamentalists in America who are bigger supporters of the State of Israel than I am? Like, what does that mean? Yeah, it exists. Remember, a couple of years ago, I was on a plane going to America around this time to speak for Shavuos. I think I went early for the Yom Yerushalayim, and I turned to this woman next to me on a United flight. It wasn't an Al Al flight. Trying to make small talk. Say, where are you from? I'm from North Carolina or something. I say, how many times have you been to Israel? Thinking once or twice. I'll probably discuss Masada with her and invite her next time to go see Eilat. You know, the typical tourist traps. She says, 47. Whoa, you've been to Israel 47 times. What are you doing? You're in Israel. I don't know. Are you a diamond salesperson? Are you high tech? She's now the assistant pastor in my church. What were you doing in Israel? Say, on Saturday, we're putting on a production. It's called The Great Hand of God in the 67 War. We're putting on a play. I said, can I come? Yeah, that's part of it. It's a little bit ambivalent because, you know, they really want us in Yerushalayim for their own purposes, for their own end game. But somehow, when Jews return to Yerushalayim, the world takes notice because, and here's an important statement, guys. A Jew believes in two different quadrants of human behavior. And those two quadrants seem contradictory, but you have to believe in both. One quadrant we believe in, which is perfectly natural to our modern democratic world, is called the quadrant of free will. Alicia, you're free to choose whatever you want tonight. Sammy, everyone here has freedom of choice. But there's another quadrant called metaphysical realities. There are metaphysical realities that shape human behavior largely, and those are built in and baked into history. Now, how could those two coexist? How could there be larger forces that dictate your behavior or that dictate human history when I'm totally free and every human being is totally free? Well, that's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's job, to synthesize those two algorithms. But when Chazal say, Halacha Esav Son of Yaakov, it means Hitler has freedom of choice. But it means there are tendencies and predispositions baked into history called anti-Semitism. And as much as we want to attribute it to social, Darwin theory, economics, politics, theology, it's something baked into history. Let me tell you something else that's baked into history. Everyone knows that Yerushalayim is the center of the earth. And that's why for a Jew to live in Haifa, it's all right. For a Jew to live in Petach Tikva, it's all right, not a problem. For a Jew to live in Yerushalayim, Gush, the biblical corridor, when I say Yerushalayim, I mean the biblical corridor. There's a corridor that's called the Bereishis Corridor. And it starts in Beit El up north, and it winds its way through Shechem, down through Yerushalayim, through Beit Lachem, right where you're sitting right now, through Hebron, down to Be'er Sheva. That's called Bereishis. Bereishis, Avram visits the Plishtim. Maybe he says hello to Tel Aviv on the way. But right here is where history unfolds. Right here where you're sitting. And when Jews return to the biblical corridor, well, Jews are returning to history. When Jews return to history, then history is hurling forward. History is hurling forward, you take notice. Shir HaShirim is the book of Jewish history. It's a hard book to understand. It's a hard, hard sefer to understand. But it's if you really want to excel at Jewish history, I don't mean in your 8th, 10th, 12th grade class getting 100. I mean part of making your avodas Hashem through the historical consciousness. You got to know that sefer. You got to read that sefer cover to cover, maybe 50 times because it's a poem and it's really hard to understand. I can recommend a few places to start. And it's primarily a conversation between a man and a female. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is a male and we're the female. But being that it's a historical play, there are a lot of different secondary characters that come on stage, like a Greek play. There's the main characters and the secondary characters. Because they're nations of the world, they're involved also. It's a historical discussion. One of the most recurring characters, secondary figures, are the Benosi Yerushalayim. These are the psukim that may be familiar to you. Hishbati Eschem Benosi Yerushalayim. Hishbati Eschem Benosi Yerushalayim. Hishbati Eschem Benosi Yerushalayim. In fact, those of you who have a little bit of a literary bent, there are four oaths that are taken in the presence of the daughters of Yerushalayim. You have to divide the Sefer into four based on those oaths. That's where the end of a section is, not the prakim. Don't read Shir HaShirim, Perek Aleph, Perek Beis.
read Shir HaShirim based on literary sections, each of which stylistically is punctuated by an oath. So next time you read Shir HaShirim, oh, the oath. Okay, that's the end of chapter, not chapter, section one. Oh, here's the next oath, to read them in oaths, not in chapters. It's called literary tropes. So who are these daughters of Yerushalayim? Why are the nations of the world referred to as the Benos Yerushalayim? Why are they daughters of Yerushalayim? So here's what Rabbi Yochanan said. One day, every single nation of the world and every single city will be a Benos Yerushalayim. What is a Benos Yerushalayim? In Tanakh, sometimes a suburb is called a bas. Most famously in Parshas Chukas, where all these cities and Moab and Edma and Midian and Amori, Cheshbon, Uvenoseha, Ashdod, Uvenoseha, these were captured. Why is a suburb called a bas? Because the daughter is a satellite of the family. She's part of the family and she gets married. She's not really living in the house, but she's an extension of the family. So just like a daughter is an expansion of the family, not really under the same roof, similarly, a suburb is an expansion of the city. One day, Rabbi Yochanan says, I'm Rabbi Yochanan, source number 5, Asida Yerushalayim le'asos mitropolin l'chol haratzos. Kirech siv. Ashdod uvenoseha. One day, Beijing, Tokyo, Moscow, Paris, Johannesburg, Sydney, Melbourne, New York, LA. It's all going to be a suburb. Because what will the metropolis be? Yerushalayim. That's what they're all called, Benos Yerushalayim, because that's their future status. Good to invest in real estate. A couple of years ago, my parents were deliberating whether to buy an apartment. I said, Mom, just put your name on. Just please. So forget all the prophecy, trust me. Real estate in Yerushalayim always goes up, and they haven't stopped thanking me. Like it doubled in price like 5 years. Benos Yerushalayim. When Jews return to Yerushalayim, history has entered a new chapter. We are in a new chapter of history. It was culminating, Jews returning. If you ask me what is redemption, it reminds me, I have to get back to some person who emailed me this question. It is more redemption, is with the sense that we're living in a new chapter of history. How many chapters in Jewish history are there? Five. Pre-Har Sinai, Har Sinai through Churban, Rabbinic history, Galus 2000, and now redemptive history. Four. This is the fourth chapter. This is the final chapter of Jewish history, final chapter of human history. That starts in 1967. 1948 was an accommodation. 1948 was logistical. 1948 was, we have a problem, let's kill two birds with one stone. We have a pledge, Balfour Declaration, Peel Commission, refugees, you know what? You take a little, you take a little, we'll all go to sleep. You have the miracles of 1967. You have the historical resonance, historical ramifications that ricochet in people's consciousness. We're back in Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim is not just a place. It's a mind space. And when we're in Yerushalayim, we're in a different place. We're in a different stage of history. And that can't be replicated anywhere else. Let me tell you about people who understood that. And let me tell you about a Jewish community that consistently got it wrong and sadly suffered the consequences. So let's first start with the people that got it right. It's about the year, roughly, in rough guesstimate, 200 BC. And there are a lot of Jews living in Alexandria. I mean, you walk back to Alexandria, that's like those are the five towns of second century. Oh, you live in Alexandria, okay. Overseas program from Alexandria. We got a lot of boys from Alexandria coming to Yeshiva next year. That's where the Jewish center is, culturally, that's where. So the Jews of Alexandria write a letter to the Jews in Yerushalayim. And listen how they write this letter. It's quoted by the Yishalmi. V'hayu b'nei Yerushalayim, or people of Yerushalayim were writing a letter to Alexandria. I got it wrong. Source number 6. They would write a letter. How many Jews were in Yerushalayim in 200 CE? Not too many. Whatever Jews were in Israel were up north, where the yeshiva of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was. It was hard to live as a Jew in Yerushalayim. I'm putting the second century, first century, second century, somewhere around that time. It was hard, maybe third century. I can't imagine there was more than max 500,000 Jews in Yerushalayim. It was hard to live in Yerushalayim during the Roman oppression. Things had abated a little bit, but that's not where the centers of Jewry were. They were in Caesarea or up north. And the few Jews in Yerushalayim would write the following message. They would write, Yerushalayim HaGedola, La Alexandria Ktana. Where are you? Where are your letter to the small little outpost called Alexandria? Imagine what the people of Alexandria probably thought. What do you got? Hundreds of thousands of Jews, and you got 50. But Jews don't just live in the moment, guys. You live larger historical sweeps. I keep trying to tell you this. The difference between a Jew and a Jew doesn't live as a point somewhere isolated in space and time. A Jew lives on a line. You're part of something before you, you're part of something after you take that into account. You plan your lives, you plan where you live, you plan your decisions. Did I tell you this? I was thinking about myself engaged in a conversation with a BDS opponent. I didn't tell you this. I read some very vituperative article from a BDS member about Israeli occupation. I was thinking, let's say I would debate this person. How would I begin the debate? And I would say, you know, I don't really think this debate is going to be productive because our frame of reference is completely different. And to help you understand that, let me ask you the following question. Let's leave the whole conversation about the West Bank. How many generations of yours can you trace? I imagine if you turn to the average modern person, how many of your generations can you trace? 3, 4? Maybe. Most of you can trace 6, 7, 8 generations. I can trace 10 generations back. You've heard the stories, you have a basic sense, you've grown up with those stories, you know where you come from, you know. And not only can you trace more generations, you're very, very intimately aware of what your grandparents did and their lives and how that affected yours. And you know what? Even not just your personal generations. Who have you spent time with today? Massive amounts of time talking to people from the 12th century and the 13th century, the Rambam who tells us. So I'm sitting with you and you're describing a situation on the West Bank in 2021 and how you see it as occupation. And I'm thinking about 5,000 years. And 5,000 years ago, we were here. So our whole point of reference, I'm not saying this in a disrespectful way, but we can't even have a conversation because our points of reference are so different. When I'm judging this land and judging, I'm looking at spans, I'm ignoring 2021, but 2021 is a year amongst thousands of years. And you're looking at a 50-year history or 70-year history or not even that. What happened yesterday to Arab suppression? I'm not only diminishing the importance of the conversation, I'm just saying it's hard for us to have that conversation. Just understand we're looking at it from a different vantage point. So the people in Alexandria may or may not have had that perspective. The people in Yerushalayim had that perspective. Reminds me of a story. Everyone knows who the Meshech Chachma was. Meshech Chachma was Rabbeinu Meir Simcha Cohen, one of the great, great rabbis of Poland, of Eastern Europe in the late 19th, early 20th century. And he was a rabbi in a very, very large, famous city in the Ukraine, whose name I'll tell you in a moment, but I'll hold it as a mystery, because he was actually invited around the turn of the century to be the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim. There's a letter. I don't have the letter. I have the facsimile of the letter at home. And I have a facsimile of the letter that the people of Divinsk wrote to the people in Yerushalayim. And the letter is basically scolding the people in Yerushalayim. Like, what are you thinking? Why in your wildest dreams are you crazy? Would anyone want to leave Divinsk to be a rabbi in Yerushalayim? We're Divinsk. You're Jerusalem. There are a couple thousand Ashkenazi Jews in 1910 living in Yerushalayim. Why would anyone in his right mind give up being the chief rabbi of Divinsk to come? We're sitting here laughing when I say that. Because if you just stop the clock, hone in, 1910, yeah, Divinsk has 40 times as many Jews as Yerushalayim, or 50 times as many Jews as Yerushalayim. But you know where this is landing. You know that one is Divinsk, and we won't hear from Divinsk again, even without the Holocaust. And one is Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim is eternal. So let me tell you about the people that got it wrong twice. There is a tradition, that's why it's not written here, but it's a very, very fearsome tradition, that Jews were scattered after the first Beis HaMikdash. So guys, this is about 550 BCE. So now we're going way back in time. And most of the Jews ended up in Babel, Babylonia, Iraq, Syria, that general area, Nebuchadnezzar. But there are traditions of Jews that actually migrated after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, just like there are traditions of Jews going to Yemen, some traditions of Jews going to Italy. The Italian community places itself more or less after the first Beis HaMikdash. There are traditions of Jews making their way as west as Germany. So there are Jews who are exiled and they end up in Germany. Now it's 70 years later, and Ezra sends letters to all the Jews in all the communities across the Mediterranean basin, come back home. We're being invited back to our country, come back home. Sadly, as you know, most Jews didn't return.
How many Jews returned with Ezra? Anyone know? You don't know this figure? It's really important. You know, don't learn from history, you're condemned to making the mistakes again. 42,000 Jews returned. And because only 42,000 returned, the second Beis HaMikdash was doomed. That's what the Gemara says in Megillah. Had they all returned, that would have been Mashiach. Why did they return? Check out Rashi and Kiddushin. Fourth parak. Sorry, Yachsen. Why did they return? Because there were two things deterring them from returning to Israel. Terror, and it was hard to earn a living. Where did I hear that before? No, they didn't return. It's too hard to earn a living. But you know what? I get it. Life is complex. And as much as we urge you to come live here, we try to help you come live here, we're not the type of yeshiva that says, if you don't live in Israel, your life's a bust. We know that life's more complex than that. But it's one thing not to return to Israel. It's another thing to write the following letter, which the Jews of Germany wrote to Ezra. The Jews of Germany wrote to Ezra, you take the Jews back to Yerushalayim, we'll stay here in Germany, because they've been hospitable to us. So far, the letter's kosher. I mean, it's not kosher l'mahajim, but it's kosher. And they've been hospitable to us, and this will be our Yerushalayim. You do not use the word Yerushalayim about anything but Yerushalayim. Period. And because of that letter, the Masara goes, it's quoted in Svarim, the Jews of Germany were sentenced to suffer disproportionately through Gullus, worse than Jews in other locations. Because Jews in German communities had to bear the brunt of that terrible historical miscue. Now, this is a tradition that was stated before the Holocaust, obviously, it dates back to the 16th century, but it primarily refers to the Crusades and to the pogroms in the 14th century post-bubonic plague, which completely, I mean, German Jewry, as hard as it was in the medieval period through in England and France and Spain, German Jewry was polarized twice during the Crusades and then in the 14th century. I mean, there was an entire pocket of Jews in the 14th century after the that were completely eliminated. You can see in the Svarim, like, they talk about, oh, what happened to all the rabbis? They're all gone. We have to rebuild. So the whole 200 communities were eviscerated. And the sad part is the same Meshech Chachma that I mentioned before writes about the mistake that people were making in Germany around the turn of the century, calling Berlin the new Yerushalayim. Why is that so heinous? Because Yerushalayim is more than just a city. If you want to describe a city where Jews are comfortable and there's kosher food and there's political freedom, there's religious freedom, so just call it Munsi, but don't call it Yerushalayim. The second you use Yerushalayim, you're taking a redemptive word that's supposed to signify something more for Jews. The fact that I belong somewhere else and I'll end up somewhere else. And that's what happened in 1967. The second shift in 1967, if you're looking for quick phrases, number one, salvation. 67 war. 6 day war. Saved from death. A great turnaround. Number two, historical reactivation. The historical process of redemption is reactivated. We're returning to Yerushalayim. When Jews are in Yerushalayim, everyone takes notice. Some are strongly supportive, some are strongly opposed. And that's why the opposition to this day is about Yerushalayim. It's not incidental. It's not incidental that the opposition to our being in Yerushalayim and in Gush Etzion and in Beit Lechem and in Hebron and in Shechem is very different than the opposite. There are some Arabs who are still opposed to us being at all alive in our country. But more or less, most of this world will be very, very happy if we return to the 1967 lines and abdicated Yerushalayim and Har HaBayis in this whole area and retreated back to Haifa and Petach Tikva and Ashdod and Ashkelon. That would make everyone back. More or less, I would settle things, assuming it could be logistically feasible. When Jews in Yerushalayim, people take note of Shamu Amin Mirkasa. It creates a stir. And that's a stir which we feel is the first stirrings of our final Gula. And sadly, we lost some of that. People felt it in 67. There was an air of messianism in 67 after the war, coming to Yerushalayim. Secular Jews talk about feeling something spiritual. Rav Amital would tell us stories because he became a public figure in the post-67 environment. And that's the second layer of Yom Yerushalayim. The first layer is the military victory. The second layer is the historical rejuvenation.
The third layer is probably the one you're least familiar with, and it's therefore the one that I need most to explain to you, because it's really important. It's changed every one of your lives in a way that the first two have not yet. But this has directly impacted you and your being in this room. The Gemara, source number 8, the Gemara, the Medrash, refers to Yerushalayim as, Gabriel, can I just have some paper towels? It's a little bit more. Just a few paper towels behind you. The Gemara refers to Yerushalayim. The Pasuk refers to Yerushalayim behind you. Ki'ir shechurbo la yachdav. As a city that's woven together. Shechurbo la yachdav. The Medrash, the Shalmi, probably a famous Medrash. What is Ki'ir shechurbo la yachdav? Many meanings, but I'm not sure Ben Levi. Ir shu oseh kol Yisrael chaverim. Thank you, Gabriel. It's a city that makes everyone friendly. Chaverim. It's a lot to say here. Especially, again, in the wake of this tragedy, I feel as if this is another intersection between the tragedy and Yerushalayim, is that tremendous unity in post-Yom Yerushalayim environment. The country was very united. In fact, I read one of the post-1967 drushes of one of the rabbis, I forget which one, who made an interesting point. He said, why did we capture Yerushalayim in 67, not in 48? Evidently, in 48, the Israeli army was still divided between the Lehi and the Palmach, or the Etzel and the Palmach. And only in 67 did we have one army. So you can't conquer Yerushalayim with a divided Jewish people. You can only conquer Yerushalayim when you're united. Because Yerushalayim is the city of unity. Yerushalayim wasn't given to any one Shevet. Yerushalayim, those of you who are learning Daf Yomi, learn Ischak or Shvat. So you can't conquer Yerushalayim when you're divided down the middle. I thought it was a very interesting historical point. But the language here is not one of unity. The language is everyone's a chaver. What do you mean everyone's a chaver? Let me tell you what I think this means. The ripple effect of Yom Yerushalayim was felt far beyond Israel, history, the battlefields. One of the most incredible transformative events over the last 72 years in Israel, 73 years in Israel, and when you think about these transformative events, you think about the big events, the dramatic events, the wars, the successes. You know one of the most transformative events in the last 73 years was Aliyah from Russia. We make a big deal about Anglo Aliyah, and part of the Yom Yerushalayim ceremony is going to be we're going to give out gifts to the boys who made Aliyah in Yeshiva this past year. It's a custom in Yeshiva. But when you think about the numbers of Russian Olim who came versus the numbers of Western Olim, it's not even close. In the 1990s, Israel absorbed about 1.5 million Russians. And it was extremely difficult because the country was nowhere near its current state economically and financially. It was hard to absorb. But long term, this type of aliyah radically transformed this country. Not taking anything away from refugee aliyah, but Ethiopians and Arab Jews in Arab lands, those are refugee aliyah, and it's absolutely crucial. We celebrate it with the same, we invest the same degree, but it's not going to transform the country. It's going to stress the country. But when you take in 1.5 million human resources and engineers and doctors and educated people and citizens, more or less of a democratic state, but a democratic feel and a first world feel, you can end up 20 years later with a high-tech superpower. That's what we are. You can end up 20 years later with an economically advanced society. You can end up later with a society that has more doctors and more engineers and more high-tech and more education and more professors. That's where we are. If you ask me, how did we get from 1985 where you had hyperinflation and this country was an economic joke? Do you know how much a bag of milk cost? A bag of milk today costs 4.9 shekel or so. You know how much a bag of milk would cost in 1985? I lived through this. 75,000 shekel on Wednesday. 250,000 shekel on Thursday. I mean, sometimes people come to my house and ask me, how do I buy all these svarim? No, I wasn't a rich person. I would literally walk into a svarim store in Meir Shearim, put out a $10 bill. People would grab and say, fill up your suitcase. Take whatever you want. Dollars were gold, and anything else had no value. Just you give me those dollars, take what you want. Yeah, I'll throw in a shas. You want a rambam also, take a rambam. Okay, throw an extra dollar in. They started to price goods in dollars, which was a real national crisis. How could you price goods in stores in dollars? But otherwise, it was a joke because you'd have to update the price every day. I mean, you spend half your day in the store updating the prices. You're supposed to be selling your produce and your food, and you have to just change the prices. It was a financial circus here. And we emerge from that in part because we absorbed HR. And HR is far more important than other resources and gold and ore, because those all come and go, gold. But HR is durable, even resources. How did this happen? This was a miracle. Natan Sharansky once said, I think it was a private conference, I remember it was like in some private conference, but he said this before public. He said, when I was growing up in Russia, I had no clue about my Jewish identity. I didn't know that I was a Jew. I didn't know what a Jew was. I didn't know Torah, mitzvot, David, nothing. State of Israel, nothing. I knew one thing. I knew that to be a Jew is to be hated. That was the entire core of my Jewish identity was, I know for some reason they hate me. And that's pretty reflective of an entire community of millions of Jews who had their entire Jewish identity frozen, completely suppressed. I remember in the early 70s, sadly enough, one part of my family, of my grandfather's family, got stuck in Soviet Union. And my cousin Jakub came to visit us. And he was sitting in Brooklyn across the table from me having breakfast. He was visiting our home and he was a Communist Party member. So he came in this full Communist Party regal. I was sitting there under the table shaking my legs. I think he's probably put a nuclear bomb in a suitcase or something, about to bomb my house in Brooklyn. I was ready to get under the table for the nuclear fallout. He gave me a little Russian tank, a mechanized tank. I brought it to school. I was like really proud of myself. All the kids were jealous. A couple of days later, the battery runs out. So my father and I like opened the back of the tank. We're going to go to the drugstore and replace it with some batteries. But it was a Russian battery, like some big block with the red star oil. Okay, toss it out. Toss that one in the garbage with all my other action figures. What good is that going to do? I knew these Jews. They were not zero. All of a sudden, what woke them up? What awakened this slumbering giant? What changed the state of Israel? How did these people? Four numbers. 1967, 1967. That's when it all happened. They heard the reports, and you can ask Russian Olin. They heard the reports on the radio about the Jewish army and about Tzahal and about Yerushalayim, and something happened in their hearts, and all that ice thawed. And all that Jewish identity came rushing to the surface. And it took us as a community about 15, 20 years to get them out. I was part of the getting them out part. I would go to the UN every year and protest. I had to slip out of school because I was in yeshiva school, so I had to like give them the slip, and, you know, go to the bathroom and like go out the window. I think I'm very good at escaping, you know. Some of my high school years escaping from the authorities. So I got very good at giving people the slip, running away. They didn't know I was there. Maybe someone was in my chair. But I remember direct flights to Russia, screaming at the UN, listening to speeches, shouting, whatever. That was our platform. That was our political platform. Getting Jews out of Russia and getting them to Israel. None of this happens. None of this happens without 67. And again, you don't see it, but you just walk into a grocery store in Austria. You know how in Makolot, because there's some Americans, South Africans here, they've got a couple nice American products or maybe some Marmalite for the, you know, just because they know they, wow, we've arrived. They care about it. You can go to a front. Walk into a supermarket in Ashdod, there are five rows of Russian borscht. Five rows are, because there are millions and millions of, there's like a 2,000-to-1 ratio. Of every one American who made Aliyah over the last 25 years, there are 2,000 Russians. This is the numbers. And that's radically, radically transformed. Just look at the Knesset. Lieberman and Elkin, Yuli Edelstein. I mean, that's why they have political clout and we don't. So everyone feels drawn to their Judaism from Yerushalayim. When Jews enter Yerushalayim, it doesn't just affect people in Yerushalayim, it affects... Any Russians in this room? Ned? Not in the room, but Nachum? Who were direct products of this Russian revolution, or the revolution of Russian Jews. But I'll tell you something you're all products of. Because the ripple effects of 1967 didn't just migrate eastward to Russia, to Moscow, and Leningrad, and Stalingrad. It also migrated eastward to London, and Manchester, and New York, and St. Louis, and Cleveland, and Los Angeles. I sometimes hear boys having the following conversation, maybe in this yeshiva, maybe in other yeshivas, and it's historically a myopic conversation. Do you believe in modern Orthodoxy? Do you not believe in modern Orthodoxy? Should all modern Orthodox Jews be hung from the rafters? Should modern Orthodoxy be burnt? Should we hang him in effigy? Because now I'm from and I'm better than. And I just laugh. Because it's so historically blind. Because modern Orthodoxy saved Judaism in America. And every single yeshiva bachur learning in Lakewood today owes a total debt of gratitude to Rabbi Soloveitchik in modern Orthodoxy. You can believe that in 2021 it's already obsolete. And it's a dinosaur and it's to be tossed out the window. Maybe I believe that. But in 1940, 1950, that is the only Orthodoxy that's surviving. That's building the platform and reinforcing the foundation of Orthodoxy in America. I remember I was close once with this, Haredi Rav, who we'd visit him and go there for Shabbos, and I'd walk in with a kippah bigger than the dome with a rock, a kippah sugah that make Mark's kippah look like an eye patch, and big, green, blue, you know, the railroad tracks, and you can't miss it. And he'd walk in and say, "Where's your kippah?" I'd say, "Can't you?" He was mocking me. That's not a real kippah, he's concerned. And then, like, every once in a while, I'd meet people who used to daven in this person's shul back in America when he's rabbi in America. And that person told me, "You know, I got an aliyah in his shul when I was bat mitzvah." I said, "What? You got an aliyah when you were bat mitzvah in his shul? And I'm not from if he was giving aliyah to women." And then I met some chazan. He said, "Yeah, I was the chazan in his shul for Yom Kippur. The mic didn't work so well one year." That's what was happening in America. What was happening in Arizona happened a lot worse in Glen Hazel, a lot worse in Cape Town, and a lot worse. I mean, Orthodoxy from the old world was on the ropes. Everyone was predicting its demise. We're learning Beitzin. At some point, we'll probably learn about opening cans and packaging on Shabbos, and we'll learn about the famous tshuva of Moshe Feinstein. You shouldn't open this, you shouldn't open that, and you go back to the tshuva and you read it. There are two parts of the tshuva. There's the 99% of the part where he says, "This is probably mutter, and that's probably mutter, and that's probably mutter, and that's probably mutter." But then he says, "You know what? The end of the tshuva, no one's keeping Shabbos in America anyway, so we have to be machmer to create Shabbos awareness." I said, "Well, no one's keeping Shabbos in America." I looked at the date, it's 1927. And no one was keeping Shabbos. And my Zaidi told me that no one's keeping Shabbos because he told me that he davened in the Firmish Shul in Baltimore. And he started a club in the shul. You know the name of the club? It's called the Shom Shabbos Club. And they handed out pins and they wore pins. "I keep Shabbos." You know how many pins they had to produce? And the Firmish Shul in Baltimore in 1920, two pins. Because there were two Jews who kept real Shabbos. Because it was impossible, because otherwise you didn't have a job. And it took more guts for your modern Orthodox Zaidi to keep Shabbos in 1930 than any fanatical zeal you'll show by making 15 siyumim and holding your tzitzis down to the floor and showing how firm you are. And it took more guts for your grandfather, again, I'm a different gender, more guts for your grandfather to walk around with a kippah in 1960 in public. And that's the nature of religion. Sometimes it takes a hit and has to resurge, and each generation builds a new platform. And so it kills me when kids are afraid to be more religious than their parents. You're not defaming your parents. You're just evolving. I want my kids to be more friendly than me. I know that I was held back by the point in history that I was born into, and I want my kids to go beyond me. Going beyond your parents doesn't mean that you're contenting them or disrespecting them. Going beyond your parents means that you have resources they just weren't exposed to. They were part of a world that just didn't allow them to move forward culturally. And I promise you, at some point, even though it may be hard for them to accept it, at some point they'll celebrate that, because that's what a father wants for a son, more than he had, more than he was capable of reaching. So why am I sharing all this with you? Because the world that you grew up in, Siyam Mashas, 90,000 people, learning, summer, Torah, Hester, that wasn't the world I grew up in. I still remember the world in which Torah wasn't cool, which people weren't so religious, in which, I can tell you what I did for my summer, but I'd have to kick out the 17-year-olds in the room. we weren't learning Torah in the ancestral white collar. We weren't opening Gemaras during the summer. I saw a lot of foreign substances entering people's noses. I put it that way. A lot of activity that wasn't in Maseches Beitza. You know, if it was not in Maseches Beitza, I know. Trust me. I remember a time when it wasn't so cool to be from, and there weren't big learners. We had words for them. I'm not going to share them with you because, of course, I was on the good side. They were insulting me with the words. I wasn't insulting anyone else with those words. My point is, what happened? When did this world change? When did the world that you know of robust Orthodox communities, of Torah, of Hesder, of learning, of movement, when did this happen? It's called 1967.
Because 1967 provided one word. And that word has many different emanations and many different manifestations. You know what that word is? It's called Komimiyot. We are proud to be Jews. We're going to put our kippahs on our heads. We're going to protest for Jews in Russia. We're going to exert our political clout. We're going to come to Israel. We're going to travel to Israel. And whenever Jews feel pride, one of the outcomes of that pride is religious growth. So when I told you that every single Jew learning the 10,000 yeshiva, 10,000 person yeshiva called Lakewood owes a debt of gratitude for the Rav for fortifying Judaism in America and across the Western world in a time in which the other styles of orthodoxy wouldn't have survived, you know what else they owe a debt of gratitude to? 1967 and the return to Yerushalayim and the state of Israel and the Komimiyot. Because without Komimiyot, we're still hiding and we're still embarrassed to be religious and we're still ashamed to be and we don't. 1967, that's what the Medrash means, Ki'ir Shechur B'lo Yachtav, Kol Nase Chaverim. It's the kinetic magnetism of Yerushalayim that doesn't just change redemptive awareness or the salvation. It's that third layer, the Jewish world changes. The Jewish world changes in 1967. And whether you're living in Moscow and you want to move to Israel, or you're living in New York, and it's not really so much about Israel for some, unfortunately, but it's more about learning in Torah. It's all the same. It's all the ripple effect of 1967. Those are what I like to call the three streets of Yerushalayim. Walk down those streets on Sunday and Monday. Walk down that street and read the books, look at the YouTube videos, think about what happened in the war, learn the personalities. Walk down that second street of history where you think about what Yerushalayim has meant to so many Jews and what it means to be back in this biblical corridor, to be back in history, to be back on stage. At some point, you have to account for yourself. History is ending. What role will you play? What, when you leave this world, how will you have contributed to this world? And I'm taking one more minute, but it's a really important story. And it's such an important story. I don't know when I'll be next with you to share this story in the following context. A couple of years ago, I just went to a Shiva house today, people I didn't know. A couple of years ago, during the stabbing intifada, so two of the first victims were children of Rabbi Henkin. So I know her. I used to teach in Nishmas. I went to be in Achamako. And as I was sitting there, a group of girls came in from one of the seminaries, but they obviously didn't know her. Their rabbi was just bringing them to sit and to pay respects. So she realized that she had to reach out to them. They were awkward. They felt, you know, they were young girls. So she says, "Tell me, girls, how many books of Tanakh are there?" So the girl said, 24. She said, "Incorrect." She said, "There's a 25th book. And we're writing it now. And it's about the Jews and their struggle to return to their homeland. And my children who were killed are in their book. They're in that book." So you have to make a decision. You want to be in that book. Hopefully with your life, and hopefully with the life you built, and hopefully it'll be here. But if it's not here, you can still be part of it. But it has to be about here. Because that's where that final book is being written. And if you're going to do that, then there's a whole slice of your Frumkeit that's lost. It's a whole slice of what it means to be from that's lost. So Yom Yerushalayim is a really good time to think about how large this process is and how many layers there are to what happened on that day. That's why we celebrate. And unfortunately, fewer people do, but we have to celebrate with even greater awareness. Okay? Erev Tov, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you.